Cheddaringmas is devoted to the most important and fastest growing segment of society, to those who have come to realize that the world's political, religious, military, and economic institutions are corrupt, that they are counterproductive, that they cannot be fixed, that we should not be allied or pledge our allegiance to any of them. Our mission is to know who is working against our interest, to understand how and why they are doing so, because exposing and condemning such schemes, even if they are religious and patriotic schemes, isn't hateful, it's caring. In our concluding hour, we're going to use evidence and reason to explore the Torah, which means teaching, not law, because it's liberating, it's enriching, and empowering. Covenant provides the only reliable answer for you and your family. Our phone number, if you'd like to participate in this discussion, it's 877-300-7645. I must ask, since the United States made the statement, what obligation does the U.S. have on the continent of Europe? Really? What obligation? I thought that a country and its elected officials have an obligation to its citizens. A national government should be keenly involved in justice to see that certain individuals aren't trampling the rights of others. They should be involved in a common project for the common good. Roads, infrastructure, you know, electrical grids, water delivery systems, sewer systems, this kind of thing. They should create an environment where people have the opportunity to be well-educated so that they can make good decisions. No, I can understand that America's military, that America's politicians should have an obligation, if you will, to do the right thing for Americans. But why does America have an obligation in Europe? And most importantly, why would America have an obligation in the Ukraine? No vested interest in Ukraine. That is remarkably stupid that we make such statements and that such statements go unchallenged. There has been a lot of fanfare over the anniversary. I don't think it's the 10-year anniversary of a Arizona football star getting himself killed in Afghanistan. I'm not going to use the NFL player's name because I'm certain that his family still grieves at their loss, and I am sorry for them. But I do want to speak a little bit about the incident. Confused by patriotism, this young man gave up a promising career in football to go join the army and play soldier. It was a tragic mistake, but one that is all too common in a nation that uses propaganda and patriotism to create an emotional response as opposed to a thoughtful response. What we did in Afghanistan and Iraq militarily were both counterproductive. We turned bad situations into far worse situations. We ought not have invaded either country. But this man went. He went through his basic training, learned to kill, and was sent on a mission. On that mission, their transport vehicle broke down. Now, the logical thing, since they were sent out to hunt down and kill Afghanis and Pakistanis, depending on whether the Taliban members were Afghani or Pakistani, and they're both, logic would say that if you were sent your men out to kill the locals, that if they radioed in that they had broken their vehicle and it was immobile, that if they were sent into hostile territory, that you'd send a helicopter out to retrieve them. Your men ought to be worth the cost of the fuel consumed in that flight. At the very least, you'd send out a larger dispatch of soldiers in a more easily defensible caravan of vehicles to go retrieve them. but no. Some numbskull in the military probably still has his job, said, now what we ought to do is to break into two groups, and we ought to leave the vehicle. Now, I don't know if this particular vehicle had a 50 caliber machine gun, but it should have if they were going in to confront an enemy. It should have been loaded with all sorts of defensive weapons. And so the logic says you stay with the vehicle. But no, they didn't do that. They set out on foot. And worse than that, they didn't just set out on foot. They broke into two groups. And so when they were encountered by the enemy that they sought to hunt down and kill, one group was pinned down and the other group, trying to come back to rescue the other group, couldn't tell the bad guys from the good guys. And this victim of American patriotism was killed by friendly fire. The Defense Department lied. They wanted this football star to be a recruiting hero and to help them draw ever more victims into this unforgivable war. And so they lied. Say that, you know, he died fighting the enemy. That wasn't true. It is a story that should have opened eyes. Unfortunately, it didn't, and is still being played out as if the football player is a hero. Yesterday and the day before, Korean President Park Geun-hye has condemned the conduct of the crew of the ferry that sank, calling it akin to murder. That is reprehensible. Now, it is true that the captain of the ferry was off attending to business in his quarters, whatever that business may have been. We do not know. And a young woman was at the helm, 26 years old. And she said that as she tried to maneuver the ferry, that it turned more sharply than she had thought it would, and that this led to the shifting and ultimately to the capsizing. She clearly was not prepared and qualified to run the ship. And it's also true that neither the captain nor this third officer gave abandoned ship orders clearly or in a timely fashion. And they themselves managed to get off a ferry that left others trapped to die. The question is whether anything they could have done differently would have saved any lives other than not having a ill-prepared, unqualified individual at the helm. And murder requires premeditation. There is a 0% possibility that this young woman or the captain, who is in his 60s, thought, hey, you know, I think it'd be a really fun thing to do today to capsize this ship and kill a bunch of people. To make such a suggestion as the president of a country is grotesquely irresponsible. It means either he does not know the meaning of the words that he is deploying, or he's grandstanding. There is a very troubling news report that can be found if you were to Google the B612 Foundation, or you can probably Google Comprehensive Nuclear Test Ban Treaty Organization, the CTBTO. But I think your best bet would be the B612 Foundation. They released a visualization showing where sizable asteroids have hit the Earth in recent years. Boom, boom, boom. The presentation uses data that was collected by an expensive American institution that should have long been mothballed, this Comprehensive Nuclear Test Ban Treaty Organization. The CTBTO operates a network of sensors that listens for clandestine atomic bomb detonations. Of course, there haven't been any. But between 2000 and 2013, the infrared system cataloged 26 major explosions on Earth, the smallest of which was 1 kiloton, the largest of which was 600 kilotons. Now, to put that in perspective, the bomb that destroyed Hiroshima was 15 kilotons. So it has heard explosions on Earth that are 30 times greater than the atomic bomb that wiped out an entire city. 30 times greater. And there have been 26 of them. They aren't atomic bombs. They're asteroids. Striking the Earth with regular frequency. Now, here is a period of time of 13 years, and during 13 years, there were 26 major explosions. Now, I don't claim to be a math major, but if I divide 26 by 13, I get 2. 2 strikes on the Earth every year, most of which are greater than the atomic bomb that took out Hiroshima, and one of them 30 times greater. We're a shooting gallery. Now, what's interesting about these asteroids that strike is that while most of them disintegrated high up in the atmosphere, there isn't any of them that was detected by NASA or any scientist probing the sky more than 1 hour in advance. One of the 26 was discovered an hour in advance of impact. Of the other 25, wasn't known until the boom. We are extraordinarily vulnerable. And Yahweh speaks of an asteroid strike in the middle of the tribulation. You can be assured it's going to happen, and you can be assured that we have absolutely no way to do anything about it, and these massive impacts are taking place at a rate right now of 2 times per year. It is another thing that most Americans are undervaluing, underrating, as it relates to our survival. Many times on this program, I've covered the onslaught in the Sudan, where the Arab and fundamentalist Muslim government in the Sudan preyed upon the Christian and animist population of the south, and over the course of about 15 years killed 2.5 million people. It's the least known genocide, and yet the worst genocide since World War II. And yet it gets very, very little attention. Well, there is an aftermath of it that is going on now in the South Sudanese area. Now, there was a peace treaty that ultimately severed the southern Sudan from the Islamic fundamentalist north. And while they gave the South Sudanese some oil fields, that agreement did not negotiate the transit fees where all the pipelines run through the north to free water ports. And therefore, the north just said, well, we'll just charge you 100% of the profit that would be attributable to that oil. And so the situation is desperate in the south. That does not excuse the fact, though, that the two thugs that are vying for power in the south are killing people in significant numbers. It's not like the Muslim onslaught that the world was so silent about, but it is nonetheless horrible. And what strikes me here is that all we give is a little lip service to this. It's the same thing that occurred, of course, when 2.5 million Sudanese were being murdered by the Muslim regime. We provided occasional lip service, but that was it. And yet you look at the Ukraine and 70 people are killed, and we act as if the Ukraine is the state of Florida, and that we as Americans have this obligation to go finance them, arm them, defend them, and speak as if they were part of this country. And yet we don't do anything related to the Sudan. Suggests maybe that we're racist as a nation, that we care about white-skinned people and we don't care much about black-skinned people. That might not be, maybe a different reason. I'm open to suggestions, but 2.5 million people dying and you don't do diddly squat on their behalf. It, you know, if we had invaded the Sudan versus Afghanistan and Iraq, the difference would have been, rather than making bad situations worse, there would have been no way to make the situation in the Sudan worse. And none. If we had taken out the Islamic regime in Khartoum, there is zero possibility that we could have made that situation worse. Just because of the magnitude of the genocide. But we didn't. This story says that the South Sudanese rebels seized a town last week, separating terrified residents by ethnicity before killing hundreds. This is a racial fight now. And ethnicity, they're all, well, there are Arab Muslims, and there are African Christians and animists. The animists outnumber the Christians by, I think, a fairly significant number. But this now, by ethnicity, I would assume, would be principally tribal. Residents sought shelter in churches and mosques and in hospitals where the rebels subsequently raided one after another. We believe that at least 400 people were killed in Bentiu in the past week, said Toby Lanzer of the United Nations. He's an official in the South Sudan. In one mosque alone, more than 200 civilians were reported killed and 400 others were wounded. Others broadcast hate messages, declaring that certain ethnic groups should not stay in Bentiu, and even calling on men from one community to commit vengeful sexual violence, that means rape, against women from another community. This is typically the call of Islam. In this case, I don't think there is a religion in particular that is associated with one group versus the other. Although this is a place where Islam and Christianity have been at war. At one hospital, newer men, newer does not new, N-E-W, but N-U-E-R men, women and children who refused to cheer for the rebels were killed, according to the United Nations. The newer N-U-E-R community backs rebel leader Riek Machar, while his rival, President Salva Kiir, is a Dinka. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. In this conflict that is ongoing here in the southern part of the Sudan, now, this is a region that suffered the worst genocide in, since World War II, with 2.5 million black African animists and Christians succumbing to the onslaught of fundamentalist Arab terrorists. While the world did nothing but occasionally flap its lips, is now continuing, but in a at a lesser pace. And it is a battle between the tribe of Nuer, N-U-E-R, and the tribe of Dinka, D-I-N-K-A. The Dinka is the largest ethnic minority in the southern Sudan. They represent about a third, in fact, slightly over a third of the population. The Nuer represent about 16%, or they're half the numbers of the Dinka. I did do a very quick review to see if there is a religious component to it, and it appears that there is. The Dinka were were almost universally animist. They believed that the spirits of trees and rocks and stones and streams, you name it, the sky, spoke to people. So they're animists in the sense that they worshipped Mother Nature. They, to some degree, were converted to Christianity, but their variation of Christianity is sort of like the Christianity in South America, where it's an equal blend of tribal paganism and in some aspects of Christianity, which is really just an amalgamation of the Babylonian pagan religion of the past. As it relates to the Nuer, who are being victimized here by the animist Dinkas, back in the time that the onslaught, the genocide began between the North and the South, the Nuer chose to side with the Muslims. So there is a significant religious aspect to this, with the Dinka saying, you know, I am not too old to remember that Islam slaughtered 2.5 million of my family. And at the time, you, Nuer, aided and abetted them. You allied with them. And so while it does not justify what the Dinka are doing, at least it provides a context to understand this horrible set of affairs. Hello, Glenn. So why do you think that the United States seems so preoccupied with 70 dead people in the Ukraine and didn't seem to care when 2.5 million Africans were dying at the hands of Islamic militants in the Sudan?
They're black people half a world away who don't speak English. That's simple.
Aren't the Ukrainians half a world away and they don't speak English?
But they're white.
Yeah, so your view is that we are racist. Our leadership is racist.
One element.
But we have a president of the United States who is a black man who is focusing all of his energy on trying to start a war with the Russians over the Ukraine, while he provides lip service to what's happening in the Sudan. Certainly, he's not racist.
Well,
actually, he is a racist. He was brought up by Reverend Wright, who was a racist, a African Christian, an African American Christian, who preached against whites.
Well, as much as his mind has been manipulated throughout his life, I can imagine he's probably profoundly confused on numerous fronts. But some would accuse him of being an Oreo, and others would just accuse him of being just manipulate dead and manipulative, you know, to these things.
Yeah, it could be that he has seen himself as the great savior, and if you're going to create a legacy for yourself, it's very difficult to create a savior legacy at the level of, for example, Washington or Lincoln or Franklin Delano Roosevelt that doesn't involve going to war and shepherding your country through war. And so he's done his level best to start a war with Russia in Damascus, and now he's trying to start a war with Russia in Kiev. So perhaps he has megalomaniac tendencies and is trying to position himself as the warrior king and savior of America through war.
Yeah, and or at least that's how his handlers are trying to position him. But at least he has offices in Harlem. That was our first black president, Bill Clinton.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yeah, it is interesting that that we are wholly unwilling to do anything to stop the Islamic onslaught against innocent people in the Sudan. That we put our toe in the water ever so briefly in Somalia to try to feed the innocent victims of Islamic abuse. But quickly said, you know, that's not much fun. Those guys play mean, and we left with our tail between our legs.
If they wanted to be involved, Well, obviously, if they want us to be involved in Africa, you know, the way the French got involved in Mali and stuff, you know, they have to have commodities, resources under their soil, you know, and then like gold, because the French need to get that gold out of Mali so that they can, you know, so they can give it back to the people with whom they're supposed to have gold on deposit. And if Sudan doesn't have gold, one thing I wanted to point out about the Sudan story is the story you just talked about involved more deaths than the Malaysia 370 and the Korean ferry stories put together.
Of course.
It won't get anywhere near anything but a minor fraction of the amount of press. I mean,
yes.
Almost barely honorable mention.
It almost sounds like it's if the media is not racist. It would be hard to accuse the media, as liberal as they are, of being racist. Then what you'd have to assume is that they think their readers would be uninterested in stories emanating out of Africa, that would mean nothing to them, and that the deaths of large numbers of people in the savage way is way too complicated for them to explain. So let's follow the big story that our readers are interested in, which is this us standing up for the thugs and deadbeats and anti-Semites in the Ukraine.
But the media are racist. It's just they pretend to be buddies of all the racial minorities. It gives them plausible deniability so that when they do negligently, you know, or when they do deliberately neglect racially significant stories, they're off the hook. They make great professions of caring about race. But they rarely, you know, their efforts rarely reflect that.
Well, you would be saying that an example of that might be that being extraordinarily liberal, they would champion women's causes. And yet the greatest threat to women in the world today is Islam, where 200 million Muslim girls are abused by the religion. And it's the single greatest concentration of evil against women, with 200 million victims. And yet they never, ever write an article demonstrating that this carnage against women is unacceptable, reprehensible, and needs to be stopped. So it's all pretense and hypocrisy.
Oh, yeah. I mean, nor do they ever do a story about how much larger the black population in America would be if they weren't having so many abortions. You know, if they'd still be in minority, but they'd be a much larger minority percentage if they weren't having, committing so much
abortion. A disproportionate number of abortions.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, yes.
There's one other thing I would say. Oh, about the Korean president's use of the word murder. Well, the word murder is obviously inappropriate. It could say something was lost in translation there, or perhaps the word freight words like criminal negligence or vehicular homicide might apply nicely.
Oh, vehicular homicide, negligent homicide, is a term that would apply nicely. No, he meant murder. There was nothing lost in the translation. I read his entire statements, and based upon what he said, he meant murder, and he used the word incorrectly. And
right.
We ought not inflame passions and villainize things. But it all gets right back to the same situation, which is that the world seems to understand and wants to have villains. So the reason that the Ukraine story plays is because the world is making Putin out to be a villain when he's got nothing to do with it. And in this case, you don't want to blame the technology. You don't want to blame the currents. You don't want to blame the cold water. You don't want to blame the survival systems on the ferry. It's just easy to have a villain. So let's name the captain as the villain. The woman's name has only appeared once, and you'll never read her name again. But who was actually at the helm. So let's just blame the
Poroshenko.
Yes.
You mean the one in the Korean ferry thing. Yeah. That's Hazelwood and Prince William Sound and Exxon Valdez all over again.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And I want to point this out about the the dumbing down of professionals and stuff. Airplane pilots who don't know how to land airplanes.
Right.
You know, ship captains who flip ships over.
Right.
To ram them into things. Even U.S.
Right.
Navy ships have struck other vessels in recent years.
Right. Yeah, we don't seem to realize that preparation matters. And I think we're so accustomed to simulators and video games that all you have to do is reboot or play the game again, and everybody is alive, and you go on with your game. In life, you can't reboot. There's a lot of issues in life where there is no mulligan. There's no I want a do-over.
Right.
There's no cheat of the system. And we are sending way too many people out impaired in terms of their inability to exercise good judgment and make good decisions. And what we're witnessing in the way that we're dealing with the Sudan versus the way we're dealing with the Ukraine is fundamental to this problem. We're not exercising good judgment.
Yes, it's amazing. And that coupled with just blatant narcissism, like what kind of money can I make in this business? You know, and like what I do in nursing, you know, when nursing, you know, began to emerge as a stable job with a decent income, it drew a lot more people who weren't in that sense of vocation.
Correct. Yes, right now it is, it's one of the better jobs in terms of both pay and the fact that there are more openings than there are people to perform the job. Senator John McClown of Arizona said on Monday that Russia is a gas station masquerading as a country. It's a gas station run by a mafia that is masquerading as a country. Now, it's not just that he said it, he actually wrote it. If you really want to resolve a problem, if you want to come together with another country and come up with a way to resolve what you think is a crisis de jour, you know, there's nothing that beats having your politicians besmirch that country. Russia. Having a history that goes back over 1,000 years. Russia. A country that is either the second or third most powerful nation on earth militarily. Russia. The largest nation on earth today. Russia. A gas station masquerading as a country. Now, if you want to talk about a gas station masquerading as a country, you know, Saudi Arabia comes to mind. Kuwait comes to mind. Bahrain comes to mind. Qatar comes to mind. Those are gas stations masquerading as countries. There is nothing to them other than oil. If it were not for oil, it would be a desert wasteland. Nothing of value. That's why for millennia, the civilized world just bypassed the Arabian Peninsula. There was nothing there. No reason to conquer it. It would be like trying to herd cats. And so the Senator of the United States, John McClown, thinks that the way to resolve this is to besmirch Russia, to say Russia is a gas station masquerading as a country. Oh, that's so grown up. Seth Meyers, who gave McCain the opportunity to tell jokes on the Late Show, recognizing that McCain is a critic of President Barack Obama, as well as Putin, he asked McCain, who ran against Senator Obama in 2008 presidential election, how he would project a tough front without turning the Ukraine issue into world war. How do you project this idea of toughness, John, without being willing to go to war or have some sort of armed conflict, which seems like something no one should want, Myers said. He said, I'd be giving them some weapons with to defend themselves, McCain said, referring to the interim Ukrainian government's military. Yeah, that's what McCain wants to do and did. in Syria. How'd that turn out, John? 200,000 dead and counting. Ultimately, it'll be millions dead. Yeah, nothing says peace than more than weapons. You want to have peace? You want to resolve an issue? Provide one side with weapons while the other side has to combat those weapons. It's no wonder we are lost as a country. He also cited other measures, giving them money to help get their economy back on track. How does giving somebody money get their economy back on track? Doesn't it just simply make them more indulgent, more dependent? Didn't John do his math and realize that no one has ever loaned the Ukraine money that got their money back and never got their economy on track? It just caused them to welch on one deal after another? Didn't John realize that when you give weapons to the Ukraine, the Ukrainians steal them for themselves? They find a way to not skim the normal skimming. You know, normal skimming in politics and the industrial, military industrial complex is about 5%. No, the Ukrainians have developed this to the point where they skim, according to the Ukrainians, 80%. What good is that going to do, John? Well, John's voice evidently resonates in the White House because today the Ukraine's acting president, and mind you, there's no government in Ukraine, it's an acting president, has ordered the relaunch of military operations against the pro-Russian militants in the east after two men and one local policeman were tortured to death. All right, so they kidnap and kill police in Kiev, and that's A-okay, because now they're acting like presidents. But their opponents killed two individuals, and they don't even know who killed them. And that means that we should send the military after them. Make sense to you?